Financial Shock. A 360-degree look at the subprime mortgage implosion and how to avoid the next financial crisis. Author, Mark Zandi. Financial Earthquake. Watching a financial crisis feels much like watching a natural crisis, as long as you're watching from a distance. Of course, each can create enormous damage and can be breaking for those directly involved. The repercussions last well beyond the immediate shock. Nearly everyone is affected at least indirectly, and each leaves scars that never entirely disappear. The subprime shock was as serious as a financial earthquake, as any nation has seen since World War II. This includes both losses on thousands of defaulting mortgages and the decline in value of securities backed by other shaky loans. Housing boom. American homeowners were historically reliable, paying on their mortgages even in tough economic times. Indeed, since the Great Depression, house prices nationwide had not declined in a single year. U.S. housing produced trillions of dollars in mortgage loans, a huge source of assets to securitize. Borrowing costs plunged and mortgage credit was increasingly ample. Housing was as affordable as it had been since just after World War II, particularly in areas such as California and the Northeast, where homeownership had long been a stretch for most lenders. First-time homebuyers also benefited as the internet transformed the mortgage industry, cutting transaction costs and boosting competition. New loan products were invented for households that had historically had little access to standard forms of credit, such as mortgages. Borrowers with less than perfect credit history, or no credit history at all, were able to get a loan. Of course, a subprime borrower needed a sizable down payment and a sturdy income, but even that changed quickly. As home sales took off, prices began to rise more quickly, particularly in high-regulated areas of the country. Builders could not put up houses quickly enough in California, Florida, and other coastal areas, which had tough zoning restrictions, environmental requirements, and a long and costly permitting process. The house price gains were modest at first, but they appeared very attractive compared with the still-bottom interest rates banks were offering on savings accounts. Some buyers saw a chance to make outsized returns on homes by taking on big mortgages. Underwriting collapses. As they anxiously watched loan origination volumes top out, mortgage lenders searched for ways to keep boom going. Adjustable rate mortgage loans, ARMs, were a particularly attractive way to expand the number of potential home buyers. ARMs allowed for low monthly payments, at least for a while. Although borrowers have had access to such loans since the early 1980s, new versions of the ARM came with extraordinary low initial rates, known as teasers. In most cases, the teaser rate was fixed for 2 years, after which it quickly adjusted higher, usually every 6 months, until matched higher prevailing interest rates. Homeowners who took on these exploding ARM loans are the ones who are losing their homes most quickly. Lenders also began to require smaller down payments to allow homebuyers to avoid paying mortgage insurance. Lenders counseled borrowers to take out second mortgages. For many such borrowers, the amount of the first and second mortgage together equaled the market value of the home, meaning there was no cushion in case the value declined. Such creative lending worked to support home sales for a while, but it also further raised home prices. Rising home prices together with high interest rates undermined house affordability even more. By 2006, most subprime borrowers started to put down little or no money of their own on their homes, meaning they had little to lose. Many had overstated their incomes on the loan documents, often with their lender's tacit approval. By any standard, such lending would have been viewed as a prescription for a financial disaster. Regulators and rating agencies. Federal and state regulators may have been nervous about runaway mortgage lending, but they failed to do much about it. Many borrowers didn't know their mortgage payments were likely to increase, much less when they would adjust higher or by how much. Regulators couldn't keep up with lenders who were constantly devising ways to elude oversight. The Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, the agency that regulates stock and bond sales, also regulates REITs. Yet, the SEC was focused on insider trading at the time, not predatory mortgage lending. Recession. The Fed's actions signaled that policymakers were working hard to stem the financial crisis. With the entire financial system suffering losses, and with every corner of the credit markets in disarray, loans to consumers, business, and even the state and local governments became scarcer and more costly. Banks aggressively ratcheted up their lending standards, Borrowers who normally were considered good credits and could readily get a loan now couldn't. Without credit, home sales buckled, and subprime borrowers who had hoped to refinance before their mortgage payments exploded higher could not do so. Foreclosure seemed the only option. Inventories of unsold homes surged, and house prices collapsed. China muscles in. Where did all this global capital come from, and why did so much of it end up in the US housing market? The answer begins in China at the turn of the millennium, just as the new Chinese economy was bursting onto the global stage. The catalyst for China's stunning economic ascent was its entry into the World Trade Organization, WTO. Membership in the international organization that sets the rule for trade among its members conferred economic advantages of lowering barriers and opening doors. The Chinese leadership had long lobbied to join the WTO, and it finally happened in 2001. Entry into the WTO significantly opened up global markets for China's goods. Because manufacturing is so important to most global economies, China's rapid grab of the global market share caused wrenching adjustments in many places around the world. Outside of China itself, the principal beneficiaries of the country's ascent were American consumers. No other nation produced more items for US store shelves than China. By 2008, more than a tenth of America's imported consumer goods were crossing the Pacific and through the ports of Los Angeles or Seattle. Big US retailers, most notably Walmart, showed themselves extraordinarily adept to setting up efficient supply chains, from Chinese factories to container ships to US shopping malls or internet catalog sites. Prices plunged. The cost of Chinese sweaters to computers plunged by 20% during the first half of the decade, enabling US retailers to actually lower the prices on the goods they sold to consumers. Inflation had given way to deflation, outright declining prices, in most stores. These bargains were too good to pass up. As consumers scarfed up the deals, the nation's import bill and trade deficit ballooned. The red ink in US trade with China was $50 billion. The Chinese began to expand their portfolios to include US agency bonds, debt issued by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Finance Board to fund their own purchases of US mortgage loans and securities. Model hubris. Lenders believed deeply that, whatever their guts told them, their statistically based, computer-driven could reliably determine whom they should lend to, what kind of loans they could offer, and how much interest they should charge. The models were brilliant, like the credit score, using available information on the borrower and the property. They would forecast the odds of the borrower paying regularly and on time. Yet, these models are only as good as the information that goes into them. And by 2007, the information going into many models was increasingly suspect. Borrowers had figured out how to manipulate their own credit scores, not by improving their habits, but by making a few simple adjustments in how they manage their debts. For instance, some borrowers paid a fee to be added as an authorized user on the credit card accounts of people with higher scores. The positive payment information from the good cardholder improved the additional user's credit score. Such transplanting of credit DNA wasn't widespread, but it shows how borrowers were able to game the system and affect lenders' models. Lenders' models depend fundamentally on the premise that history is an accurate guide to the future. Most times this is a reasonable assumption, and models will predict the behavior of borrowers reasonably accurately. But at times, such as during the housing boom, conditions don't match anything experienced historically, and then the models no longer work. In the housing boom, lenders failed to recognize this. Their belief in the predictive prowess of their models emboldened many of them to throw aside philosophical concerns and make what later proved to be colossally bad decisions. Back to the future. Though it's quite disconcerting to find many banks without enough capital to withstand the credit losses, there are still to come. Yet the worst of the crisis appears to be over upon contemplating the following top 10 list which policymakers have to adopt in order to address the future. Policy step number 1. Adopt a voluntary mortgage write-down plan. Many troubled mortgages could be salvaged if lenders would agree to modify them, typically by reducing the principal owed. The borrower could get to stay in the house, the lender would avoid a costly foreclosure, and the economy might avoid falling into a destructive, self-reinforcing cycle in which house price declines beget foreclosures, which beget still more price declines. Policy step number 2. Establish clear mortgage lending rules. whereby lenders must consider the borrower's ability to repay and also verify the borrower's income and assets. Policy step number 3, licensed mortgage brokers. Because unregistered brokers were among the most unscrupulous lenders during the housing boom, state banking regulators are working to set tougher standards for brokers by requiring applicants to pass proficiency tests and to be fingerprinted by the FBI. Policy step number 4, expand data collection. A lack of timely and accurate information hobbled policymakers' ability to respond to the subprime financial shock. Also, no government agency tracks the number of mortgage foreclosures. A ready mechanism for expanding the government's data collection efforts is required by the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. Policy step number 5. Reform the fractured foreclosure process. A federal foreclosure process should standardize the time between a mortgage loan default and an auction. 1 year would be reasonable, because that's approximately the median current length of time among the states. Policy step number 6. Invest in financial literacy. The nation's financial literacy contributes to a wide range of poor decisions on borrowing, saving, and investment. Policy step number 7. Modify mark-to-market accounting. Instead of marking an asset to the price that prevailed last quarter, institutions could use the average market price of the asset over the past 4 quarters. Policy step number 8. Raise the financial transparency and accountability. Transparency means timely, meaningful, reliable, and complete information is available regarding financial products, institutions, and markets. In transparent markets, financial players borrow, lend, and buy and sell aggressively. In opaque markets, players are uncertain, and they tend to panic in time of trouble, just as they did during the subprime shock. Policy step number 9. Overhaul financial regulation. Instead of agencies monitoring specific types of financial institutions, regulators would specialize in various types of financial risks and activities. Policy step number 10. Pay attention to asset bubbles. Examples of these bubbles are the rapidly rising prices, increased leverage, surging trading volumes, and the arrival of less sophisticated buyers to a market where they have little experience. Policymakers won't enact all the reforms on the aforementioned list soon. Nevertheless, some substantive policy changes are coming. Financial institutions and markets have also begun the task of repairing themselves. Funds are raising billions from institutions and wealthy individuals to prepare to buy up distressed properties and securities. Thus, the most daunting challenge is a personal one. We must each prepare for the financial crisis by carefully considering the condition of our own balance sheets. We will all have to save more and be more careful how to invest.